You go out and you vote. You watch all the debates on TV.
Oh, yeah. And you celebrate when your candidate finally wins.
Right. And then, I mean, like 3 years go by and you realize your property taxes are exactly the same.
The zoning laws haven't budged at all.
Exactly. And the same, like five massive companies are still essentially running the entire internet. It really makes you wonder,
Oh, absolutely.
like, why does it always feel like the people we elect aren't actually the ones in charge? You cast your ballot, the faces at the podium change, but that underlying feeling remains.
That there's a club running things.
Yeah, and you are decidedly not in it.
It is an incredibly visceral feeling. And, historically, it tends to lead people into one of two traps.
Enjoy.
Well, either you check out entirely because you think the whole game is just rigged, or we see this a lot. You start falling down these convoluted conspiracy theory rabbit hole.
Oh, right, looking for some secret cabal in a
Yeah,
smoke-filled room somewhere.
exactly, which is exactly what we want to avoid today.
Totally. Because what if that feeling isn't a conspiracy at all? What if it's just, well, the basic undeniable math of human society?
That is the core of it, yeah.
So that is our mission for today's deep dive. We are going to uncover who actually runs society, how they do it, and most importantly, how we can prevent them from holding all the cards.
And we have some incredible source material for this today.
We really do. We are pulling from a massive, comprehensive new report. It was literally published today, August 1st, 2026, prepared jointly by the American newspaper and American TV.
Right, and they've done this deep, systematic analysis of the political theory of Gaetano Mosca.
And Mosca is, he's just the perfect lens for this.
He really is, because he was just a pure realist. I mean, he wasn't interested in drawing up blueprints for some ideal utopia.
Right, he didn't care about who should rule in a perfect world.
Exactly. He wanted to look at the mechanics of who actually rules. So, our goal today is to take a very calm, completely impartial look at how power is structured right now.
We're tracing the lines of influence, basically.
Yeah, from formal governments all the way up to big tech and these massive
Okay,
conglomerates.
let's unpack this. Because Mosca starts by basically taking a sledgehammer to, like, the biggest myth in politics.
Oh, the illusion of the majority.
Yes, the myth that the majority inherently holds the power. I mean, we are taught from kindergarten that because there are millions of everyday citizens and only a handful of leaders, the people are ultimately in charge.
Right, but Mosca argues the exact opposite. He says that in every complex society, a small, organized minority will always govern a larger, unorganized majority.
It's kind of hard to wrap your head around at first.
It is, but it's the bedrock of his entire framework. He
Yeah.
calls it the political class or the ruling class.
And it's not because they're necessarily smarter.
Right, no, not at all. When Mosca analyzed history, he realized the contrast between rulers and the ruled isn't that the rulers are inherently more virtuous or even that they start out richer.
So what is the actual advantage then?
The advantage is entirely about organization versus dispersion. It's a classic collective action problem. 100 coordinated actors will always defeat 1,000 isolated ones.
Okay, think about it like trying to decide on dinner with a chaotic group chat of like 50 people.
Oh, wow. Yeah, a total nightmare.
Right. Versus a tight-knit group of three friends who already booked a reservation. The 50 people in that chat, they have way more total hunger. They probably have way more money combined, but they're just completely scattered.
Half of them are arguing about sushi versus pizza.
Yeah. Another 10 haven't even read the messages, and five are just, sending memes. Meanwhile, the three friends have a plan, they have a car, and they have a table waiting.
Those three friends are going to dictate the night.
100%.
And what's fascinating here is if we take that group chat analogy a step further, it perfectly illustrates these cumulative mechanisms of elite advantage.
Because they have a head start.
More than that, it's not just that the three friends booked a table. It's that an organized minority possesses a shared command structure. They have dense communication. They have internal discipline.
While the unorganized majority, the 50 people in the chat, they have to expend enormous amounts of energy just to establish a basic common interest.
Right, they have to argue just to pick a temporary leader for the night.
So the coordination cost is just way too high for the 50.
Exactly. And while the majority is arguing, the minority is acting continuously. They have organizational capacity.
Meaning they control the budgets, the offices, the daily routines.
Yes. Plus, they have privileged information. They're reading the expert analyses and the private data long before the public even knows there is an issue.
And they have rapid leadership. They can literally make a decision in a closed room and execute it by noon.
While the rest of the country is still waking up and reading the morning headlines.
Right. And I think it's important to mention, the report clarifies this, that calling them the unorganized majority doesn't mean ordinary people are incapable.
Oh, no, not at all.
They are just structurally dispersed. Mm-hmm. You go to work, you take care of your kids, you pay your bills. You don't have the time or the machinery to mobilize every single day.
But, and this is key, if that majority ever does manage to coordinate, say they form a massive labor union or a highly disciplined political party, they stop being unorganized.
Right. They actually transform into a new organized minority themselves.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Which brings up a very practical problem for the rulers. If this small organized political class controls all the levers of power, why doesn't the massive majority just rebel?
I mean, honestly, why don't they?
Well, if it was just naked coercion, just guys with weapons forcing everyone to comply, a society would bankrupt itself trying to pay enough guards to keep everyone in line.
Right. Force is just way too expensive. You can't put a guard on every single street corner.
People have to want to obey, or at least accept it as legitimate.
And that is where Mosca introduces his next major concept, right? Mm-hmm. The political formula.
Yes, the political formula. This is the legal or moral doctrine that moralizes power, because human beings generally prefer to obey an abstract principle over a specific person.
So it's basically the story a society tells itself to justify why the people in charge get to be in charge.
Exactly. It translates raw organizational dominance into accepted authority.
And looking back, that story clearly changes based on the era.
Oh, absolutely.
Like in medieval times, the formula was religion, like the divine right of kings. I get to sit on this throne and tax you because God himself ordained it.
Right. And then later on, you see nationalism. We rule because we embody the sacred destiny of the nation.
Or socialism, where a party claims the right to rule on behalf of historical progress and the working class.
And of course, democracy and popular sovereignty, where authority is justified by the claim that it flows upward from the consent of the people through elections.
The report also mentions the rule of law as a formula.
Right. Yes. Where officials claim their power is completely subordinate to impersonal constitutional rules. But the key mechanism here is that the formula has to resonate with the specific moral vocabulary of that society.
Because you couldn't use the divine right of kings in modern America.
No, the culture just wouldn't accept it. The rulers would be laughed out of the room. The formula has to fit the era.
Okay, I have to push back here, though. Is this just a really cynical way of saying that all of our deepest political ideals, like democracy, equality, the Constitution, are just pure propaganda?
It sounds cynical at first glance, I know.
Yeah, just designed to keep the masses quiet. Because that's pretty bleak.
It is, but there's a much deeper nuance at work. The political formula is not just a lie cooked up in a boardroom. Rulers very often sincerely believe their own formulas.
Okay, but even if they believe it, does it change anything?
It does, because the formula actually creates a trap for the ruling class. Once a regime claims to govern through a specific principle, the public can hold them to those exact standards.
Wait, how does that work in practice?
Well, if you justify your power by telling the public, "We rule through the impartial rule of law," you eventually have to build courts.
Right.
And eventually, a citizen is going to use that court to challenge you. If a ruling class completely ignores its own formula, it loses its legitimacy and its power base crumbles.
So the formula constrains the rulers just as much as it pacifies the ruled.
Exactly. It creates the actual rules of the game.
So what does this all mean for the lifespan of these ruling groups? Because, I mean, rulers age, they retire, they pass away. How does the political class maintain its grip across generations?
They reproduce.
Right.
And the mechanisms for this are very tangible.
Like family inheritance.
Yes, family inheritance, passing down massive property, legacy admissions to elite universities, party apprenticeships. Every ruling class builds a pipeline.
Right.
But the long-term survival of a society depends almost entirely on whether that pipeline is open or closed.
An open elite versus a closed elite.
Right. And open recruitment doesn't mean a perfectly egalitarian utopia. It just means there are functioning institutional channels for new talent and new social interests to enter the political class.
So things like competitive exams or open elections or dynamic economic entrepreneurship.
Exactly. Absorbing outsiders is actually how an elite stays healthy and competent.
But when an elite becomes closed, that is where the entire system starts to break down.
It really is. Mosca's diagnostic sequence for how regimes collapse is fascinating because it's so predictable.
Right. First, you get closure. The elites start exclusively hiring their kids or people from the same three Ivy League schools.
They engage in nepotism and selective law enforcement. And why that's so dangerous is because it immediately causes an information failure.
Because they're in a bubble.
Exactly. When you only surround yourself with people from the same prep schools and gated communities, you literally lose the data feed from the working class. You stop knowing what is happening on the ground.
And that information failure means they start making policies that seem completely disconnected from reality.
Which breeds resentment.
Yeah. And eventually, corruption.
Yeah.
Because they are no longer accountable to the outside world, the gap between their stated ideals, their political formula, and their visible privilege just gets too wide.
And the formula loses all its credibility. And once the formula is dead, the elite fragments. Factions start fighting each other.
Which creates a vacuum.
Yes. And finally, a new, hungrier, better organized minority steps into that vacuum and replaces them.
Which brings up a massive trend happening right now. Populism.
Oh, absolutely.
We see these populist movements rising up everywhere, claiming they're going to tear down the corrupt elites, drain the swamp, and give power back to the everyday people.
Right.
Based on this report, do populist movements actually destroy the elite, or are they just swapping out the players?
If we look at this impartially through Moskis' framework, and the report is very careful not to take a political side here, populism acts as a powerful counter formula.
Okay, so a new story.
Exactly. A populist movement can absolutely blow the doors off a closed, stagnant system. It mobilizes neglected groups, but mechanically, they do not destroy the concept of the elite.
Right. They just operate by concentrating power in a new leadership cadre.
Yes, a new political class that claims exclusive, authentic representation of the people.
So they might bypass old institutions like the traditional media or the established courts, but in doing so, they basically just build their own machinery.
Precisely. And often that new elite ends up being far more unified and centralized than the fractured, corrupt elite they just replaced. The actors change, the formula changes, but minority rule remains intact.
Wow. Okay, so elected officials are one thing, but here's where it gets really interesting for me. If we look at who actually owns the infrastructure of power today in August 2026, we have to look way beyond just politicians.
Absolutely.
The analogy I love for this is thinking of politicians like guest stars on a long-running TV show.
Oh, that's perfect.
Right. Like they come in, they do a season or two, they get a lot of screen time, they make a lot of noise.
But they don't own the sets.
Exactly. The people who actually own the studio, who own the cameras, who build the permanent sets, they're the ones truly in charge. Elections might swap out the guest stars, but they don't change the studio owners.
That is the best way to visualize it, because the networks, the specialized expertise, and the institutional routines persist underneath all that electoral churn.
The permanent political class.
Yes. First, you have the bureaucracies,
yeah.
The senior civil servants, the military brass, the regulatory agencies. They possess the procedural memory.
A politician makes a grand promise on a debate stage, but the bureaucracy actually writes the rules and decides if that promise is even executed.
Exactly. And then you have massive conglomerates and financial capital. The report points to South Korean cables as a prime example of this mechanism.
Those are the massive family-run business conglomerates, right? Like Samsung or Hyundai.
Right. Historically, the state helped fund and protect them to rapidly industrialize the country. But now, they've grown so massive, they control such a staggering percentage of the GDP that the dynamic has completely flipped.
The reciprocal relationship changes.
Yes. These conglomerates now have so much concentrated resource power that they can essentially dictate terms to the state. They don't need to be on a ballot to be a core pillar of the ruling class.
Their corporate strategies outlive any presidential administration.
Exactly.
But what really blew my mind in this report is how this applies to big tech. Mm-hmm. We don't typically think of like a 28-year-old software engineer in a hoodie as the ruling class.
No, we really don't.
But if you look at the mechanics, platform executives and engineers are designing the algorithms that define the default rules for human communication.
Instead of allocating physical resources, they are allocating attention and visibility at a global scale.
Yes. Think of the algorithm like a digital city planner.
Okay, I like that.
This city planner gets to decide which businesses get the massive highway off-ramps and which are left stranded on dead-end dirt roads. They rank the search results, they moderate the content, they invisibly shape what millions of people see when they wake up.
What's fascinating here is that they have their own specific political formulas to justify this immense power.
Right. They don't claim divine right.
No, their formulas are innovation, algorithmic neutrality, or optimizing user choice. But structurally, it is pure Muskian power. It combines tight organization with massive information asymmetry.
Because they have all our data and we don't have theirs.
Exactly.
Okay, I can feel my heart rate going up, honestly, because if organized minorities, bureaucrats, billionaire conglomerates, tech executives always hold the reins, doesn't that mean democracy is just an illusion?
It can definitely feel that way.
Like, shouldn't we just throw our hands up and accept that we're all pawns?
Not at all. And this is a crucial pivot in the report. Moskin did not write this to make people fatalistic. He developed a concept to counter this exact despair.
Juridical defense, right?
Yes.
Juridical defense. It sounds very dry and legalistic.
Yes. It does. And it includes formal law, certainly, but it is much broader than that. Juridical defense refers to the entire ecosystem of social mechanisms that protect individuals from arbitrary tyrannical rule.
It's like due process and an independent judiciary.
Yes, but also a free press, the right to assembly, public opinion, and most importantly, institutional rivalry.
So power checking power.
Exactly. Mosca's ultimate philosophy is often called realist liberalism. He accepts that you can never fully abolish elites. Dreaming of a perfectly flat society usually ends in disaster.
Right.
But you can keep elites divided, you can force them to compete aggressively with one another, and you can bind them in a web of legal constraints.
Wait, doesn't this theory just let billionaires and oligarchs off the hook, though?
How so?
Well, it sounds like we're just saying, hey, elites are natural, don't fight it, just let them be.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it actually provides the only practical weapon against them. Moscow was fiercely opposed to monopolistic rule. Compare him to Karl Marx. Marx focused almost entirely on economic ownership as the root of all power. Moscow broadened that lens, proving that political organization itself is power.
Because a military junta can crush a society just as completely as wealthy capitalists.
Exactly. The ultimate defense against any of them is ensuring that multiple autonomous associations have the freedom to organize and push back.
So the goal isn't to pretend everyone is perfectly equal. The goal is to make sure the people with power are constantly sweating because someone else with power is looking over their shoulder.
That is a great way to put it. The report contrasts Mosca's view with Robert Dahl's theory of pluralism. Dahl basically argued that having lots of different minority groups competing against each other, unions, business lobbies, environmental groups, is what meaningful democracy looks like.
And Mosca agrees that pluralism is the absolute goal.
He does, but he offers a double realism. He warns that even those competing interest groups are still run by their own professional political classes.
Right, so minorities will always govern, but our liberty depends entirely on preventing any single minority from absorbing all the others.
Exactly. An independent court blocking an executive power grab or investigative journalism exposing corporate fraud. That friction is what keeps us free.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
But as brilliant as this framework is, the analysis makes it clear that Moscow was very much a man of his time and he had some major blind spots.
Oh, without a doubt. He was writing in the late 19th and early 20th centuries from within overwhelming male European imperial institutions.
Right. And his theory often completely ignores how mechanisms like gender, race, and colonialism were used to legally and artificially repress entire populations.
Yes. If a specific group looked unorganized or absent from the political class to Mosca, he might not have fully accounted for the fact that they were intentionally and violently excluded through segregation.
He also vastly underestimated the agency of mass democratic movements, didn't he?
He did.
Think about the civil rights movement or the labor movement. They didn't just act as a new elite replacing an old elite. They fundamentally altered the institutional norms of society.
That is a vital correction to his work. Mass social movements do generate their own organizers, but they also create distributed capacities in the majority. They expand rights and force the system to permanently redesign its rules.
Which changes the landscape for everyone.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the landscape we're navigating today, digital politics. Because technology has completely inverted the speed of organization.
Oh, completely.
We can coordinate 2 million people on the internet in an afternoon. But the catch is that while the internet lowers the cost of coordinating, it just creates new gatekeepers.
Right. Data brokers, influencers, platform owners.
So how are you, listening right now, supposed to navigate a digital landscape where the gatekeeper isn't a person in a suit, but an invisible algorithm?
This raises an important question about what juridical defense looks like in the 21st century. Algorithms feel invisible, but they are built by organized minorities.
Because they're coded by human engineers.
Exactly. directed by corporate executives and funded by venture capital. So the defense against them has to be equally structural.
I'm starting to see it. If an algorithm at a major corporation starts firing employees because its logic dictates that's the most efficient move,
right,
and the CEO just blindly obeys it because efficiency is their political formula, that algorithm is essentially acting as the ruling class.
It is. So modern juridical defense means demanding structural counterweights. Things like strict data privacy rights, forced interoperability so you aren't trapped on one platform, and independent algorithmic audits.
Technology changes the speed of organization, but it doesn't change the need for it.
Exactly.
And we've covered a massive amount of ground today, from the illusion that the majority naturally rules to the political formulas that make us accept authority.
And the terrifying rot of closed elites.
Yeah, and how true power hides in bureaucracies and code. If there's one thing you take away from this deep dive, let it be this. Being unorganized is your only true political disadvantage.
That's the real takeaway.
Whether you are prepping for a boardroom meeting, analyzing the knitters, or just participating in a local community group, the math remains the same. Power belongs to those who coordinate and communicate.
And as we navigate this increasingly complex era, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, building on that idea of the algorithm as a manager.
Okay.
We know that a political formula has to match a society's moral vocabulary to keep an elite in power, right?
Right.
But what happens when artificial intelligence begins generating its own formulas? If AI systems eventually acquire the ultimate organizational capacity, the most privileged real-time information, and total network control,
oh, wow.
Will human beings inadvertently become the new unorganized majority ruled by an algorithmic political class?
That is just...
Yeah.
From a chaotic group chat deciding on dinner to an AI political class managing humanity. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been great.
Take a look at the structures of power in your own life a little differently today. Notice who booked the reservation. Notice who set the agenda and ask yourself, how can I get organized? We'll see you next time.